Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming Outlander series or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 43 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. Well, before we get to announcements, I would just like to say that I'm so glad to be back in studio this week. It's so much nicer to be able to do this with you face to face.
To do this with me?
Yeah.
You mean...
To do the episode. It's harder to do it when you're in different states.
Yeah.
It's hard. So, I'm glad to be back. But it was a nice week off, but I'm glad to be back and back with you guys here. This week's announcements, we got some pictures from Star's Instagram account. The first that we are bringing up here is a picture of our resident Gaelic expert, Agav, with a giant cheat sheet.
Cue card.
A giant cheat sheet cue card. For the actors.
Aren't cue cards the epitome of a cheat sheet, though?
It really is. But it looks like it's spelled out phonetically, but am I the only person who doesn't know how to read phonetic spellings of things? Like, little kids can do it and I can't do it. Nobody ever sat me down with like, the dictionary of phonetic spellings.
The thing about phonetics is everyone has a different way of writing a phonetic system. Usually each language has their own. I cannot speak for Gaelic. I can speak a little bit for English. English is just kind of messed up. English is literally a bastard language. It takes on everything and has, like, no one mother or father. It has, like, many, many sources.
Yeah, no, that's totally true.
Mostly Latin and a lot of Greek. And then, of course, the Anglo-Saxon and Angle influence, but also French and from the Normans. I mean, English is just a mess.
It's just a bastard.
It's a mess. But, I mean, I think it's beautiful, but it's a mess.
I would not consider English a beautiful language. It's a very harsh language when you think about it.
Well, it's not as...
it's not a romance language.
Yeah, but not all romance languages are necessarily beautiful, to my ear at least.
Well, to our ear. But I know a lot of people who would say that the German is not pretty to listen to. I, however, enjoy listening to German.
But that's because...
We speak it.
Yeah, so it's a whole different thing. And, of course, I believe French is beautiful. I believe German is beautiful.
But see, French and Italian are considered romance languages.
Yes, but I do like listening to Spanish, and I like listening to
another language.
Yes, and I do love Italian. Italian is gorgeous, but there are some romance languages that I will not name that they don't sound as smooth to me, I guess, as those. But about phonetics, the funny thing is, let's speak about German. German is, I mean, the words may be, some words may be a mile long, but once you know the phonetic workings of the German alphabet, unless it's a loan word, right? A word from a different language that's used in German, the spelling is very consistent and the pronunciation is 100% consistent.
Yeah.
If it's a French word that's loaned into German, then it's going to be, for the most part, pronounced in a French way. Same with English, which makes me laugh when I hear German speaking.
Oh, I laugh.
A German word, da-da-da-da-da, and then they throw in an English word.
Coca-Cola.
Super. Well, that's... Yeah, that's... Technically, that's Latin, but yeah, it's taken in from the English. But that's kind of backward, isn't it? But yes, as far as phonetics go, English is a mess. And I do remember, like, learning, they tried to give us like phonetics that are used in dictionaries. Like, even I love Merriam-Webster. It's a great dictionary. It's the quintessential dictionary of American English, whereas Oxford is, of course, British English, right? The thing is, I can't speak for Oxford. I haven't looked that far into it, but I know Merriam-Webster. They do not employ IPA. IPA stands for International Phonetic Alphabet. I'm not sure what Oxford does, but I think HarperCollins, there are a few dictionaries, especially foreign language dictionaries, that do use IPA, and I started learning IPA in my diction class for music.
I don't speak IPA.
Did I say not speak? Even a little Can I say bit. Speak today? I hope not.
I don't understand it. I can't read it.
It is another sound, it's a sound symbol system, right? It's like an alphabet, but right. It's all different sound systems. Brought in, which is kind of cool, from Latin, Greek, even a little bit of Norse. It's very interesting. And once you learn it, the cool thing is you can write English in using IPA. The whole point of IPA was to have a unified system that could be used to spell out or to write out the phonetic system of any language.
How long has that been around?
A while.
Because
at least 50 years.
I know that I don't read it at all. No. Like, not even a little bit. Like, if I see it, I'm like, yeah, that doesn't help me.
I used to be really good at it when I was using it. It went from music to then to language to me, because we never learned it in high school. I learned it in college, and I had to keep up with it. But I never... The thing is, think about it. It's really useful for singers who don't speak the 85 languages that they're singing in.
That's true.
But and you put the diction above the line or below.
True, but what I will say is that I think they're teaching kids that these days.
IPA?
To a degree, because I've seen some of those things, and I've seen some 5- and 6-year-olds be able to use those to sound words out, and I'm like, dude, you're better than me. I can't do that.
Is it include a symbol like this?
Like with a double... Oh, I don't know. I'm like with a double E with the exclamations and the...
Wait, like that?
Like all kinds of stuff like that. I don't read any of that.
That's not IPA.
Well, what is that?
That's funky, whatever someone wanted to call American English.
Well, I can't read that phonetics. Either. Well, then I can't read anything other than straight up English.
IPA is again, international. I'm not saying everyone uses it, but it is an international standard for linguistics. It started with linguistics. So, that having been said, you can use IPA for German, but the thing is, if you speak German or if you even know what the sound system is like, the sight sound correspondence, what you see is what you get. And again, unless it's a loan word, then kind of all bets are off. You have to know how it's pronounced in that language, which can kind of shoot you in the leg.
So to bring it all back to this picture.
We can't
I don't even know. And I can
the first
tell
word
that some
looks
of
like
it,
cha-cha.
Like, I can see they've underlined some words to show that that's, you know, maybe that's it's phonetically
stress.
Spelled as to how to spell it or how to pronounce it or how to stress it. But, like, I know that sewer is not an actual. I know that they're not actually, that's not the word. On number 05, it says, Von nach Biere.
Now that was even, you're trying to
speak German
there.
I know, because I speak German. Anyway. But my point is it ends with the word sewer.
Okay, number 6, I can figure out one. Well, the FO1 I can't, but Von nachele. Nachele? Nachele? I know that nachele, and I'm guessing, therefore, nachele is...
Oh my God, I hope Agav doesn't listen to this, because I think we're embarrassing ourselves right now.
We already said we don't speak Gaelic, and we definitely cannot reverse engineer this Gaelic phonetics. Even if he's perfectly fluent, whatever, you know, familiar with IPA, it probably is too much of a step in this short of time that they have for all these episodes and so much Gaelic that they have to say, okay, here it is on paper, let's work on pronunciation. I'm going to have these cue cards up here. If he had cue cards up, in some funky symbol language, right? That might be too much. Because their goal is not to learn this international phonetic alphabet to help them pronounce anything in the world. They just want to know what this is. But they have to, of course, agree on it. He made up something that they can understand. They probably went over the phonetics beforehand as well. Not just with the actual Gaelic, but with the actual phonetics that he wrote.
Oh my gosh, I think we just spent like 15 minutes talking about this.
But it's interesting.
It is interesting.
I'll have a link to something about IPA. Right. I think it's interesting.
You definitely should, because I still don't know what we're talking about.
IPA, I told you. International Phonetic Alphabet.
All right. The next picture that Outlander Star's Instagram account gave us was it looks like a shot of the actual filming. So you're kind of behind the cameras and kind of far away, just kind of looking down. Like, you can see some of the set people and things like that. The people that are not, you know, the actors dressed for the time period. But it looks like they're setting
the
scene.
It's like the left is actors and the right.
Right.
Well,
exactly.
The right,
well, because
the
they're
right
probably shooting
corner.
Towards the left.
Yeah,
is what they're doing. But the Outlander caption is, "Where could Claire be headed?" # Outlander series # stars # 18th century # stable # Scotland.
And so the only word you need to look at is stable.
Right. So we know she's on her way to see Mr. Jamie. Which, can you blame her?
And
I
she doesn't
blame
look
her.
Like she has a picnic basket with her. But I mean, she goes.
You
out
don't know.
There, I think,
it could be a huge basket. She could have to carry it in front of her.
But it looks like her hands
you don't
are
know.
Down.
You don't know what she's doing.
It looks like her hands are
you're
down.
Not there.
Somewhere.
You're not in front of her. You don't know what she's looking at. You don't know what she has
it's
in her hands.
It's a still shot.
You're a still shot. Anywho. We also got a picture. Is this another Instagram? This is on the Twitter account. Twitter. Outlander Stars Twitter. It was a picture of four of our Mackenzies. And I like this shot. But what I've noticed is that I can tell how old a shot is based on the length of Sam's hair. And this shot looks like it's probably maybe 6 months old.
At least.
But he, and they all look so not tired, which is another, you know, way that you can tell that it's maybe not as new of a shot as it could be. But I think they all look fantastic.
I like the hats, the bonnets that Duncan, the Claw,
and
Ronnie B. Goodwin are wearing.
Yes.
Excellent.
And I think that's the most I've seen Graham smile.
He's full on laughing at something there.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's...
Sam looks like, so innocent. Like, that's such an innocent smile.
Again, he's early Jamie.
Well, he's definitely pulling off the virginal Jamie look. So we got these next shots, care of www.seat42f.com. They had a bunch of promo shots, and a lot of them were things that we've already seen, but there were a few new ones. They had a new shot of, it's a scene we've already seen, but I haven't seen this angle of Claire and Jamie on horseback with Rupert in the background, and I just love his face in the shot.
This is strong warrior Jamie. And he's injured at this point, right? Because he's injured pretty much as soon as she goes back.
I mean, he was injured when she showed up.
That's what I mean.
Like,
so he's
probably, he spends the first half of the book injured in some way, shape, or form, and then he gets injured again.
He spends the whole first book injured. I think he spends like half of every book injured.
I think he has like a moment of peace where he's not injured in the middle, and then
we already finished it. It's Dallybrock.
I know.
But he looks, oh, that face. Well, okay, his face is great, okay? The hair is fine, but it's just that this is where, it's the look he has on his face, and it's straight onto the camera, which is hard to do for some people. It's hard to do.
But it's not really straight onto the camera, because he's not looking at the camera.
No, but it's his face is straight on. There's no angle here. I mean, there's angles on his face, but she's not straight on. She's cheating a little bit to her right, but he looks pretty darn straight on. But just love the look on his face and the seriousness and the angles of his jaw, all that. And she looks like, before it was like bitchy Claire. This is freaked out, what the F, where am I Claire?
But what I'm going to say is that if this is the same dress that she was wearing before she went through the stones, that dress has been torn up.
And dirtied.
Like, I would almost think that that would be like, it almost looks like a sheet with sleeves in it. Like, it doesn't look like it has any definition. It's just like this big, like, I would almost call it a shift. Like, it almost looks like a nightgown, which I guess would explain why they thought she was traveling around in her nightgown. So I guess good on you, stars.
A few people may have mentioned it. I did not, because my eye is pulled to Jamie and Claire. But this horse is stunning.
He is stunning. I do just, not think that is not Donis.
No, we don't meet Donis till the stables, I don't think. But and there's Rupert in the background, Grant O'Rourke. It is a little bit of an optical illusion. It does kind of look like a little tiny Grant is riding on the back of Jamie's horse. But, obviously, he's but he's on his horse behind them. But a lot of people were commenting about that, and I thought it was kind of funny. But Rupert looks just, he looks great. They all look
it's
so
a
good.
It's very appropriate. It's a good look for
very
Rupert.
Very much so.
This shot, this next shot that they have, I know I have not seen this shot before because I have not seen that dress. Purple dress before, that beautiful purple dress. But it's a shot of Claire and Frank, and I'm assuming the B&B.
It has to be, because, you know, they talk about the wallpaper, and I think it has to be.
It has to be. There's no other place they are together indoors, really, honestly.
Yeah, except they're when they're walking through Leo.
And then, you know, they visit Reverend Wakefield. They're briefly
and we haven't
in
seen
his,
shots of that,
his,
right?
No, in his parlor.
Yeah.
And then I think that they spend some time someplace else. But for the most part, when they're in Scotland in the beginning, they're in their B&B. When they're inside.
And it's really nice.
And it's nice. It's a good shot.
It's like, if I would caption this, I would call it like Before the Fall or something. I don't know. It's just sad. It's a nice shot. And of course, I love seeing Tobias, but it's just, it's kind of heartbreaking to see them. I know we're whole Jamie Claire fans. I get it. That's not going to change. But it is kind of heartbreaking to see her with him because she spends the first 6 months almost. She married Jamie about 6 weeks after she went back. But it's about, I think we figured it was about 6 months between her falling through the stones and her birthday-ish. Like, right? Because they end up back at the stones for that decision on her birthday. And she goes through the stones, like, right around Jamie's birthday, right? May 1st, 2nd, something like that. So, May to late October. It's just about six-ish months. So, she spends almost that entire time up until just before the witch trial trying to get away.
Yeah.
And so this is so fundamental. We've said this a million times. It's so fundamental to get this relationship right and to portray her, how much she is truly lamenting the loss of Frank.
We also got another shot of Claire at the Stones. Now, we've seen a lot of shots from this scene, but this is a new shot. Yeah, but this is a new shot. I haven't seen this particular angle yet. But it's another nice little shot of her with the shawl around her neck and the white dress standing in front of the Stones. So it's not a new scene. Oh, and this is the first shot. This next one, they have another shot of her on the ground in the same white dress, which sitting makes me think on the shawl, which makes me think that this is her just... If she's, like, just waking up, like, just falling through the Stones. But this is the first real shot we have of that dress underneath the shawl.
Yeah, without being covered up.
With the little keyhole neckline.
I wonder, we never see it again. Well, we never see it again in the 18th century. That little belt goes missing.
Almost immediately. Yeah, the belt goes missing almost immediately. Like, it must have, like... As does the shawl, apparently.
Well, yeah, she probably doesn't take it with her. Looks like she
probably gets up off the ground.
Stands up and to see what's going on, and
I don't know, but it's a pretty dress. Outlander is holding a red carpet event during the San Diego Comic-Con, Friday, July 25th, where they will be screening the first episode of Outlander.
It's a world premiere.
And they had a contest. They have a contest where you can go online and enter.
Yeah, 100 winners, and 100 winners. Each get a plus one.
Mm-hmm. So, I don't know about you guys, but I entered. Did you enter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would really, really like to go. And last but certainly not least, I think this is honestly the most important news of the week. I mean, obviously, the contest for the tickets to the premiere is pretty big. However, this, I would say, is the biggest news of the week. And that is that Diana Gabaldon is number one on the New York Times bestseller list, not in one category, but in two categories, for combined print and ebook fiction, and for hardcover fiction. So Written in My Own Heart's Blood is at the top of the New York Times bestseller list. And I think that we all have a little to do with that, that we've all went and purchased her book, I know, with all the pre-orders and everything like that. But I know that I personally am only on, like, chapter 40-something, but because I'm listening in tandem with someone on our audiobooks, but... I'm really excited. I'm really enjoying it. It's been really good. And I know everyone, the people who are ahead of me keep giving me kind of like spoilers that aren't spoilers. Like they're kind of giving me vague spoilers, if you will. And I don't want to hear it anymore. So until I'm done, I don't want anyone to talk to me about it. But it's really good. And if you haven't already purchased it, go get it. Moby is amazing. And now on to our read-along. We are reading chapter 39.
No, we have read.
We are discussing.
There you go.
Chapter 39. To Ransom a Man's Soul.
It's the next morning, and Claire goes in to check on Jamie. But she is stopped by Myrta.
Welcome back, Myrta.
Yes. He walks with her away from the room and says that Jamie is okay, but that he doesn't want to see her just yet. He says that Jamie thinks it's best for her to leave with him and go back to Scotland. At that, Claire's like, out of my way, mofo.
Right, and I want
to say... Rushes back into the room.
I know, but I want to say that that was such an abrupt...
Change.
Yeah. For him. I mean, I'm sure for Claire as well, but that came way out of left field. Like, that was... Of all the things that I was expecting from these characters, the first time I read this, I was like, wait, what? I mean, it just seems like giving up, and neither of them are the type of people to give up, so I was always very confused when that first came around.
So Claire goes into the room and says, look, I won't touch you, but you have to speak with me.
Well, she won't touch him because he, like, pulled away from her.
Yeah, so she pulled up a stool, and she's like, look, you gotta talk to me. He says that he should have let Randall kill him, and he said, I had no reason to live, but I was not brave enough to die.
Well, brave enough because he... was afraid that if he had died, he would not have gone on. He understood why the prisoner had killed himself.
Oh, yes.
Afterwards, and he says, I wasn't brave enough to do that because...
I know it would...
I knew that would damn my soul, yeah. And I want the, you know, heaven if that's what comes next.
So Jamie gathers the courage to tell Claire about his time in Wentworth from the moment that she left that room, that cell. The worst part, he says, is that while he planned to let Randall do everything he wanted to him and not think of Claire, Randall had not allowed that.
No. He wouldn't have enjoyed that at all.
He'd asked if she did this, meaning Claire. Does Claire do this? What would she think, seeing us here like this, etc.? In other words, he kept her face front and center in his mind while raping and abusing him.
Right. So now he has an
association. So now there's an association that Jamie has between Claire and his time in the dungeon.
And I will say it was a good thing that he told Claire that this happened, because otherwise, because this book is told from Claire, we would never have known
exactly
what happened.
What we're going to share now is a clip, courtesy of Recorded Books, in which Jamie tells Claire he can no longer be with her.
It's all linked for me now. I cannot think of you, Claire. Even of kissing you or touching your hand without feeling the fear and the pain and the sickness come back. I lie here feeling that I will die without your touch. But when you touch me, I feel as though I will vomit with shame and loathing of myself. I can't even see you now without... His forehead rested on knotted fists, knuckles dug hard into his eye sockets. The tendons of his neck were sharply etched with strain, and his voice came half muffled. Claire, I want you to leave me. Go back to Scotland, to Craignadun. Go back to your place, to your husband. Myrtle will take you safe. I've told him. He was silent for a moment, and I didn't move. He looked up again with desperate bravery and spoke very simply. I will love you as long as I live, but I cannot be your husband any longer, and I will not be less to you. His face began to break apart. Claire, I want you so badly that my bones shake in my body, but God help me, I'm afraid to touch you. I started up to go to him, but he stopped me with a sudden motion of his hand. He was half doubled up, face contorted with internal struggle, and his voice was strangled and breathless. Claire, please, please go. I'm going to be very sick, and I don't want you to see it. Please. I heard the pleading in his voice, and knew I must spare him this one indignity at least. I rose, and for the first time in my professional life, left a sick man to his own devices, helpless and alone.
So Claire goes before the Blessed Sacrament and prays the only thing she can. I need help, please. She gets a Bible and begins to look through it at different verses for inspiration. She finds one, and I looked it up, and it's Job 33, verses 23 through 25. And this is a quote from...
the Bible.
Well, the Bible, but also Diana's book. Our Bible, Outlander. No. If there be a messenger with him, an interpreter, one among a thousand, to shew unto a man his uprightness, then he is gracious unto him, and saith, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. His flesh shall be fresher than a child's. He shall return to the days of his youth. She commends Jamie's soul to God over and over. She continues to read the Bible, and after a time in her weariness, she realizes that she has answered a question, something that she doesn't remember having heard or received. And someone's question, this question, she answers with a yes, I will.
Maybe it could have been anything. It could have been, will you fight for him? Will you do what it takes? It could be anything. I just want to know.
Will you be my instrument to save his soul or something like that? Yeah, anything.
Who knows? It could have been anything. She did a lot of things in this upcoming chapter.
She has the feeling that she has an answer for the situation, for what she needs to do. And also, something very precious.
There was a feeling, not sudden, but complete, as though I had been given a small object to hold unseen in my hands. precious as opal, smooth as jade, weighty as a river stone, more fragile than a bird's egg. Infinitely still, live as the root of creation. Not a gift, but a trust, fiercely to cherish, softly to guard. The words spoke themselves and disappeared into the groined shadows of the roof. I genuflected to the presence then and left the chapel, never doubting, in the eternity of the moment when time stops, that I had an answer, but having no idea what that answer was. I knew only that what I held was a human soul. My own or another's, I couldn't tell.
The next morning, she finds Jamie racked with fever. The wound on his hand has become an infection, a blood poisoning. She and the monks work to bring his fever down, even bringing in snow hourly to pack around him. And Diana describes the room as just having puddles. The snow is melting and just puddling under the floor, and all the sheets are getting damp, and can you imagine? And they're cold, because they're well, but they're...
They have to keep that room so cold in an attempt to combat this fever.
They have to keep him cold, and all the stuff is... They're getting wet, and they're not able to stay warm themselves, yeah. So it's actually not necessarily good for them either, but they're trying to save this man's life. He asks her, Jamie asks her to just let him die, and she says, "Damned if I will." On the evening of the second day, the abbot comes in to anoint Jamie. Anselm explains that it is the last anointing. Claire is a little bit shocked and not too happy about this because
she's a physician. She's like, dude, I'm working on this.
She admits there's, I think there's two parts to it, and there may be more, but the two parts of this that I got was the, what do you mean it? I'm working on this. Let's not give up on him yet. I think she's afraid that if they do this, it's a sign that they're kind of resigning themselves to something.
Well,
but there's also the fact for her that it's a little bit woo-woo.
Well, it is, but you also have to think about the fact that a lot of people, when they're passing, as long as they're still fighting and they haven't given up, they stick around a little bit longer. But the minute they have that moment of, okay, it's okay to go, mm-hmm. you know, so many people say, you know, they go and tell their loved ones, you know, it's okay to go, we're all here, mm-hmm. we love you, we'll take care of ourselves, you know. And that when they have that assurance that, you know, they're taken care of, they aren't needed anymore, they can go, they go. He doesn't need any reason to let go. She doesn't want him letting go. So I think that's another reason that she's just like, I'm not ready for him to go. And you giving him any kind of absolution that it's okay to go is not okay with me.
Yes, and I think Anselm is trying to explain to her that, yes, it is typically given to the dying, but it has two purposes. It is a sacrament of healing in that, yes, they're praying for the healing of this person while administering the sacrament. However, what they say is basically, let God's will be done. If it is God's will that this person heal, then may he heal and live and be strengthened. If it is not God's will, then may his soul be cleansed. So this is also, you know, the last rites. He is able to be shriven. He's able to have his last confession. And that, which is the second part of this, the second purpose, which is the absolution of sins. If he's about to die, this, they believe, ensures a clean soul, a purer soul, to go to heaven. If he's not about to die, it can't hurt him to have, right. In his faith, it can't hurt him to have an absolution of his sins.
I mean, if he sins in the next 24 hours, then he can come back and do it again.
The scene in which Jamie gets the last rites is very emotional. It is tenderly described. Claire goes to her room, having been promised that someone would come to get her if Jamie takes a turn for the worse. But she can't sleep.
No, because she's not the type of person who can sit still unless something happens.
She's the person who sits by the sickbed.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but she's also the type of person who doesn't wait for things to come to her. She goes out and finds them. So she's
even
not,
if it means she finds trouble.
Right. She's not one who can just sit on her hands and wait. So she's more of a person of action. So for her, being told to go back to her room and wait
is really difficult.
Yeah.
So she can't sleep. She begins to set up the divining bowl, as Galas had shown her. This is that bowl where you pour the water in, and there's like a little bubble. It's the surface tension is just about to be...
It's a mirror effect.
Yeah, and I think she put the candle behind it or something. So Diana writes, "I set the candlestick behind my reflecting pool, took my place before it, and sat down to summon a ghost." So later, she goes to Jamie's room. I find it interesting that she actually does refer to this time, so it's not like we don't ever hear what she did during this time. She explains it later in the next section. But I do remember reading it and thinking, oh, she's going to end it right there and not tell us how she does it, but she refers to it later on. So later, she goes to Jamie's room, tells the monk that she will stay with him, and the monk leaves. She prepares the room for her exorcism. She lights the opium. She takes off her robe or her nightgown.
Can I just say before we go into this, the first time I read that, I didn't know who she was summoning.
But when you first read it, you don't know.
I was like, who? I was like, what ghost is she summoning?
Just the summoning, yeah.
Just to summon a ghost in it. And to me, until she got in that room and started actually talking about the lavender, I thought for sure it was Galus or somebody else. I had no idea. Because to me, even though they said he was trampled by the kine, it's like it didn't sit with me that he was actually gone.
Well, yeah, and that's all we have is the words of Macadonic, right? And maybe some of his men, too. But so she goes to Jamie's room, and she prepares for her exorcism. She lights the opium, she takes off of her clothing, and she rubs herself with lavender and valerian. And these are, I think, the dried herbs. They're not oils or anything. And then she begins to taunt Jamie in a voice as close to Randall's as she can mimic. And this just, like, gave me shivers on my spine. Actually, let me say this. We're not going to play this because we're not going to include a clip of her speaking as Randall. But it's quite convenient, actually, when you have a reader, any reader, really. But if one person is doing the same voice, Davina, exactly.
Because it sounds just like him.
Exactly. Well, Davina did, of course, Davina read the books. Reads the books, and she, of course, read Randall. But when she does, it's so weird. Yes, she does Randall for Randall, but she also does Randall through Claire. And the Randall through Claire is really sinister. She doesn't say a lot. She only says a few things, but it's very, almost like a low, it's not barky, but the word barky comes to my mind, but it's very, like, something phrase. It's creepy.
I mean, it's effective.
That's what I'm saying.
It got done what needed to get done.
Yes. So she begins to taunt Jamie in this voice that's like Randall's.
But it took me a minute because when I was reading this, I still didn't know what she was going to do. I was like, what is she doing? But then when she started doing the Randall voice, I started thinking, at some point he's going to realize she's not got all the same parts. Is that going to ruin the illusion she's attempting to create?
Let's find out.
But I like to think that that's probably where the opium came in handy.
Yeah, I think you're right. She has spent time, and this is where I was saying earlier, she refers to the summoning. She had spent time in her room conjuring memories of Frank and of Randall, mannerisms, voice, etc. And she talks about this, describes it a little bit. And I think it's so pitiful how Jamie reacts. It's so sad. Because he doesn't, at first, he doesn't violently react.
Before he starts to fight back. He cowers.
That's what I'm saying. It's heartbreaking.
He just doesn't want to be back in that place. And it's like,
and doesn't he say not yet, not yet? He says something about not yet,
please. He does. And I think it was just, you know, she had to push him.
She had to push herself.
She had to push herself and him further, even further than Randall pushed him, to get him to that place where he would fight back. Because, you know, because if he was back in that place,
he wouldn't have fought back.
He wouldn't have fought back because he promised he wouldn't, for Claire's sake. So she had, anyway.
So it's so pitiful and heartbreaking the way he reacts, and he's not doing what she needs him to do. She brings out the knife. She remarks to herself, I may not survive this. Because if he's out of his head with opium and illness and fever, and she brings out a knife, and God forbid he turns it on her, he could have full-on stabbed. I was thinking at that point, oh my God, that's right. Not only could she die by being beaten or being thrown up against something and hitting her head, he could have full-on stabbed her. I mean, there were weapons there.
It's true, but she's counting on the fact that he has been so ravaged by fever and his muscles are so atrophied that he won't be able to overpower her in the way that he would need to. But he's surprisingly strong considering everything else that's happened.
Even with fever, even having wasted away so much and lost muscle mass. I mean, that's why he's
atrophying.
So she brings out the knife, and just as Randall had done to him, she basically lightly reopens the scratch, the wound across, or a deep scratch, whatever it was. She scores his chest. Yeah, she runs it over the wound that Randall had made. And then she takes a towel and she rubs it in, or to open up the sore even more, the wound even more. And then, and this grossed me out. I mean, Claire, girl, I got to give you props. You did what you got to do. You had to take it. You had to push the envelope.
She committed.
Envelope. Oh, she was full on committed. But she takes, she took some of his blood and put it on his lips and then said, "Now kiss me." And that was not funny, but interesting. She said this was the one part of the dialogue that she didn't have to make up. She thought, yeah. I heard this part.
Oh, right.
Burr. And those are the words that I think I said before in that chapter when he said it.
Yeah, that was jarring. Give
me the squeeby jeebies.
Well, because he just bashed his hand and nailed him to the table. And he was like, "Now kiss me." Yeah.
And this is the point of no return. He reacts. And she says she did not see it coming. She was not prepared for the violence of it.
No. Well, she...
He's like, he can't move.
He's staying away to nothing. He can't get out of the bed. He can't take care of himself. But when she says that to him, and, you know, there's the blood on his mouth, and says that to him, "Now kiss me," it's like she unleashes the monster. Like, the Kraken has been unleashed. He launches out of the bed. He just... full on, the attack begins.
And thereafter ensues a scuttle between them. Jamie, given a chance to fight against Randall, and Claire, fighting for his own soul. In the end, they end up quite literally against a wall, and he takes Claire. And they fall to the ground, rolling in this fallen tapestry.
We bashed into some piece of furniture and both lay still. Jamie's hands were locked on my breasts, fingers digging bruisingly into the flesh. I felt the plop of dampness on my face. Sweat or tears, I couldn't tell. But opened my eyes to see Jamie was looking down at me, face blank in the moony light, eyes wide, unfocused. His hands relaxed. One finger gently traced the outline of my breast from slope to tip, over and over. His hand moved to cup the breast, fingers spread like a starfish, soft as the grip of a nursing child. "Mother," he said. The hair stood up on the back of my neck. It was the high, pure voice of a young boy. "Mother." The cold air laved us, whirling the unhealthy smoke away in a drift of snowflakes. I reached up and laid the palm of my hand along his cold cheek. "Jamie, love," I said, whispering through a bruised throat. "Come then. Come lay your head, man." The mask trembled then and broke, and I held the big body hard against me, the two of us shaking with the force of his sobbing.
And that is how Brother William finds them the next morning. And here, you know Jamie's back when his humor is there. And he sees the wreckage of the night before. But more importantly, Jamie's fever has broken. And since Jamie is lying on top of Claire, but she's still buck naked, Brother William focuses, Diana writes, on Jamie's left eyebrow.
It's very specific.
Very.
And that eyebrow the farthest point away from Claire? You know,
that was funny. I actually thought, because if you're... Yes, I thought about this. I'm thinking of Clay. I don't know who Clay is. Clay-me. I'm thinking of Clay-me, I guess. I'm shipping them. Diana shipped them. I'm thinking of Claire lying a certain way on the floor, and Jamie then, of course, half on her, whatever, when the monk comes in. Or was it the brother? Sister or mother. When the dude comes in. And when he sees Jamie, and he's concentrating on his... Stay with me. On his left eyebrow. Forget left, right. He has to concentrate on the one furthest away from her nipples. Right? Well, he's trying to look away. He's trying to look at them and address them, but not be near her.
I'm pretty sure her nipples are covered by his body.
I'm being facetious. The point is,
he's trying to look as far away from her as possible while still not being rude.
Exactly. If looking at his left eyebrow allows him to not look at Claire or look at her less, right? Like you said, address them, but not look at her as much. Then it can only be working one way. Depending on what side Jamie's lying on, either his left or right eyebrow will be closer to the ceiling. Anyway, that's all I'm saying. So, Brother William focuses on this left eyebrow and addresses him. He asks Jamie how he felt, and Jamie answers, hungry.
That's always a good sign.
It is. As Jamie and Claire make to get up, he says that he ought to be dead, even if part of what he remembered happened the night before. She answers, you're not. I looked. Claire. Claire has some good one-liners, too. He's usually Jamie, but Claire does have them. And together, they get him to the cot, whereupon he faints. Because he could barely lift his head, he said.
Which is so remarkable, considering under the presence of opium. Chased her around the room.
Broke benches, furniture.
Broke tables. Slammed her up against the wall.
And, yeah.
Did her on the floor. I mean,
I think he did her against the wall before they flew to the floor.
Who cares?
So Claire muses about what Myrta... Claire muses about what Myrta had said, that he'd, meaning Jamie, the heart of a lion and the head of an ox. And she adds, too bad you haven't also got the hide of a rhinoceros. He opens an eye and asks what a rhinoceros is. She tells him he needs food and rest. He tells her, what you need now are clothes. And he falls asleep. What a chapter. I mean, from the highs to from the lows to, oh, I wouldn't say this is really a high. It's a high point in drama,
no.
But a low in feeling and emotion as far as being sad and just sad, desperate. I think Wentworth was a desperation. Now he's safe, quote unquote, but now you see he's truly, well, he is dying.
He was physically safe, but he was mentally not. And,
yeah.
You know, it was like he was no longer in danger of being hanged, and he was no longer in danger of being brutally flogged to death or whatever else Randall had in mind. So bodily, he was mostly safe, but everything else was forfeit. You know what I mean? It was like he was finally in a place where he knew no one was going to kill him, but he didn't feel that he even wanted to be alive anymore. So, which in and of itself is another battle you have to fight.
So that is an interesting scenario. What Claire's felt it was her mission to do was to basically break
Randall's hold on him.
Oh, the hold, I would say, break or remake that association that Randall had instilled in him by keeping Claire's mind there while he both tortured him and, Jamie's straight up honest, pleasured him. That's what was hard, I think,
for
him.
Well, and he also needed a chance to fight back.
Well, oh, of course.
I mean, he needed a chance to not feel helpless.
Not be just the victim, exactly.
Right. So, I don't know. It's a hard chapter.
It is a hard chapter. That's why we didn't read this.
I know. But
I mean, we don't read it, but that's why I didn't give any kind of detail for what Jamie describes.
But I'm glad it ended as well as it did, because it could have gone.
Yes, it could have gone all kinds of sideways. I mean.
Well, it's one of those things that I'm glad it was something that was resolved in the course of a chapter, because if that had dragged on for more than one chapter, I would have.
We just finished 39. We're almost done with
Outlander.
Thank you.
Gosh, really?
I have not remembered the title of this book. Oh my goodness.
Which means we're 1 week closer to.
Oh my goodness.
August 9th.
We still haven't decided how we're going to handle. We know how we're going to watch the show. I think we've shared that.
Separately.
Me separately alone. Her separately, likely alone. Separately alone the first time. And then the second. And then however many times. At least once together. But we definitely will be taking notes. Probably not as closely as I did for these chapters, because that was like more content related. We don't want to retell the episode. What we're curious, we maybe not even retell. We discuss the chapters in quite a lot of depth, right? For the episodes, if we are just two, or me, big balls of tears, I mean, I just don't know. The first episode may be me talking about how I just, Summer, you go for it. I just can't talk this week. I don't know. No, that will never happen.
That would be awesome. A whole week to myself?
No, that would never happen.
What would I talk about?
The show.
You're right.
So what do you think? Not to continue this for too much longer, but our idea is to watch it separately, come together, watch it together, take notes, do whatever we're going to do, and then discuss how we felt, discuss what we thought, discuss the adaptation that was done, maybe even, this one thing I think we'd like to do is, okay, this episode one seems to cover approximately chapters one through blank, whatever it is. We're not keeping lists, we're not keeping tallies, but it is interesting to kind of see where they stop.
Agreed. I mean, obviously, it's in kind of the format of a recap.
That's true.
Of what's of what happens, but also to
the differences,
the things, the similarities, things that exactly. they may have changed, things
they took out or changed or added,
right? And you know, things that we really liked or things that you know
maybe
oh,
we forgot about,
right?
Maybe we forgot it even discussing it in the entire read along. Who knows? I definitely didn't get everything in there, although I almost got everything. I think I got a lot of most of it.
But it took us more than 16 episodes to get through the book.
Oh, man.
All right, let's call it. That was chapter 39, To Ransom a Man's Soul. Got it right that time.
And join us next week when we discuss chapter 40, Absolution.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
Last night, that my young